I'm Lisa.
And this is the Paid Media Playbook, where we talk to marketing professionals about their challenges, tactics, and triumphs.
Join us here at Double Z Media for weekly conversations about media strategies for marketing leaders.
We're here today with Jessica Ivey. Jessica is a longtime local marketing director who has just a plethora of experience and really interesting background. Jessica, can you tell us a little bit about how you got started in marketing?
Sure. Thanks for having me. This is a pleasure to join the podcast with you guys. You know, I actually started my career in commercial architecture and interior design. I have 10 years with Mulvaney G2 Architecture, and I never dreamed that I'd ever end up in marketing. But, you know, I'd say that experience really informed everything that I've done since then, because the nature of design, at least at that scale, really requires big picture thinking, holistic problem solving, you know, creative thinking. And I think that that's something that definitely is applicable in, to the marketing sector. You know, I worked on projects all over the world and really honed my skills in pivoting from the strategic to the tactical. And that you end up doing that a lot when you're, you know, working as a marketing director. You're envisioning your long-term vision, but you also have to get it done. So, you know, at the end of the day, we had to build a building and we had to get it there. But in 2010, when banking stopped funding development, you might remember, I happened to be skating with Rat City Roller Derby. And that, you know, was a hobby, but it was for the skaters, by the skaters. It was all run essentially like a grassroots nonprofit. And, you know, I was looking at what we were doing and we were spending a lot of energy. We're like spending, you know, $5,000 to make $6,000, you know, and it really was something that we did for that was empowering. It was about self-expression. It was gritty. It was underground. It was in this airplane hangar, Magnuson Park. And we had 2,500 regular spectators that would sell out the hangar. And it was a good time. It was very, and it, but you know, I kept looking at what we were doing and how much time we were investing in it. And I thought we could really scale this thing. And at the same time, the Supersonics had left Seattle. And right. So I recognized that Key Arena probably had a couple open slots. So I approached the city to negotiate a contract for us to become an anchor tenant at Key Arena, now Climate Pledge. And they thought it was hilarious. They thought, you know, sure, you guys can come in here. The Storm were already in there. The Thunderbirds at the time were there as well. And they had no idea what we would do with that space. And we ended up outselling the Storm and outselling the Thunderbirds. We sold out the lower bowl of the arena multiple times. We were an anchor tenant for 8 years. And we did some extraordinary things. We were able to attract sponsorship. We were able to increase our ticketing revenue as well as our merchandise and just become that Seattle icon, you know, that the people came to love. And we were able to empower young girls through providing accessibility to the sport. And, you know, now a lot of those girls are now members of Rat City Roller Derby. But in that sandbox was really, you know, especially once I was hired on as chief marketing officer, was a great opportunity to work with press, to work with different community organizations, to attract sponsors, to get creative with brand activation. And that was more of an organic time. The levers we had were very guerrilla, you know, postering, word of mouth, email. Social was brand new. I mean, a couple years old. It's not what it is today in terms of advertising. Digital was emerging. Mm-hmm. Traditional media was really pie in the sky for us at that moment because we did not have the budget for that. And we leaned a lot on building relationships with our sponsors that where we could leverage their audiences or work with AEG at Key Arena so that we could get, you know, press and media exposure or on air, you know, opportunities. But we did do some transit. We did some outdoor radio, did some broadcast. I skated on the Space Needle. We were definitely out in the community on skates anytime we could. And, you know, I think that as we ramped up our season ticket holder base, we were able to ramp up our paid media correlationally. I think, you know, our budget became more respectful over time, and we actually ended up producing a broadcast for Root Sports. So, you know, that was something that was no other league had been able to achieve. And it essentially, that arena model became a respected model that was replicated in other cities after we first did it. So yeah, that was, you know, my first love, my first entry into marketing and discovering that how to apply all of those early skills, those creative skills, the problem solving skills to, you know, to big challenges. And from there, we probably take a sharp left turn. And I was introduced to cannabis, and it was a ground floor of a new industry. It was early on. And, you know, there were a lot of regulations flying around, a lot of, you know, gray areas, places where people didn't know what we were going to end up doing in advertising, especially since it's still not federally decriminalized, and you can't advertise in certain media platforms. So it's very restrictive. And, you know, talk about an industry that's antithetical to marketing. It's not something that came naturally to a lot of business owners. They didn't really feel comfortable sticking their neck out and saying, hi, here's my brand. And, you know, people didn't know about packaging. They didn't know about compliance. It was very chaotic, but it was very fun because we had a lot of, you know, we could be the first to try things. And we were, because we implemented the first billboard campaign for cannabis. Now you see it up and down I-5, billboard campaign. Some are better than others, but
yours was pretty good. It was pretty good. It was, you know, using people.
It was lifestyle instead of product based. Yeah. It was not, you know, McDonald's is 2.1 miles around the corner, you know.
Right.
It was about like, this is okay. This is normalizing. This is recreational. Yep. And it was, you know, moments where people are hanging out at a concert, you know, just having a blast. And just being able to get people to visualize what, you know, the future of cannabis normalization look like, and having it feel, you know, like something that's approachable.
Yeah.
And not
normal and friendly and open. And you're talking to like Gen X and younger, I felt like, you know, and because you and had
women.
To.
Women and had women to, had to get there and understand like, oh, like edibles and vaping and all of these different, you know, assortment of products, you know, just became more elevated, more elegant.
Yes.
For them.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was an exciting time. I started my agency, Fire Creative, as a result of becoming somewhat of a subject matter expert and understanding a lot of the regulations. And, you know, I got to work on Willie Nelson's brand and the rollout there.
That's,
you know, I met Snoop Dogg twice, put him on a billboard.
Love it. Yeah.
And, you know, was able to really get creative in how we approached building community, because we produced a series of concerts called the Budtenders Ball Series, which were free concerts, but it was aimed at, you know, and this was before influencer marketing, but we called them tastemakers and really just wanted to infuse art, music, cannabis in a way that's, you know, already there, but it was just a natural celebration of, you know, the culture and wanting brands to see that they could approach community building in an authentic way where they weren't, you know, putting a brand on something and what I call like NASCARing it out. You know, you just have a natural alignment with art and music and cannabis. And so we created that series, we made it free for people to attend, brought in some really great bands, local bands, and then, you know, invited all the bartenders out to start that community. And it became kind of a place to be. Produced a concert with at the Tacoma Dome as well, the Dope Music Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Again, yeah. It just was a way to meet people where they are because we couldn't advertise to them. And advertising felt a little corporate. Mm-hmm. So, you know, mm-hmm. let's keep it cool. Let's, you know, have this time together. And here's a free t-shirt.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really all you could do at the time. Yeah, it was very frustrating. I couldn't even like ever sample. You know, it was so strict. And then the billboards, remember the billboards, how we couldn't, they would like, oh no, we just realized that's too close to a cemetery.
Yeah, I would have to go on Google Maps and like, and with a little ruler and just look at what's around where the billboards were.
I just like cemetery. Was one of the rules. Like, you can't put a cannabis because they get real offended there at the cemetery. And then after cannabis, is that when you went over to Lovers?
That's when I ended up with Bartell Drugs.
Bartell. That's so right. You went Bartell Drugs.
Was, you know, very high-paced, high churn, you know, cyclical, highly promotional, you know, pharmacy retail. It, you know, had been in business for 120 years. It was family owned. It was hyper local and its brand, you know, identity really highlighted the assortment, and they took a lot of pride in incubating local makers. And so that was a fun time to be able to work with a lot of local brands and pull them forward, tell their stories. And, you know, it's great also to have a budget, you know, when you can be, you're doing a lot of direct mail, you're doing a lot of print ads, and you did a lot of digital as well. But, you know, traditional grocery retail is very
traditional.
Yeah. And we actually were the first pharmacy retail chain to design and implement a CBD rollout. So we got to get some press around that because that was very exciting to just be first to market again and innovative. And I think that Bartell's as a brand was very pioneering in that sense. And they knew who they were. From there, I ended up at Lovers, still in the wellness category, sexual wellness. And that was actually a national chain that had been acquired. It was started off as a family run brand by a mother-daughter team.
I didn't realize that.
The investment group wanted to be able to build up the valuation. And so we developed an overhaul of their visual brand identity and the omni-channel experience. And, you know, we really wanted to modernize the brand. The brand and in the industry at large was very, you know, perceived as somewhat tawdry, something, you know, very a little male gazey. It wasn't approachable for women. You know, the places where retail were allowed to exist were not in, you know, they were in the darker corners of retail. And we wanted it to feel relevant, to feel empowering, to feel body positive, to feel diverse. And so because we actually had influencers that wouldn't work with us because they would see our social media presence and think, you know, it's a lot of, you know, lingerie and roses.
Yeah, yeah. Fredericks of Hollywood. And we were trying to get away from that old style, right?
Right. So we started telling more stories. We started bringing in new models that we weren't relying on stock photos. We actually even challenged the lingerie manufacturers to come back to us with more plus size, you know, options because we felt like that was a growing category. And, you know, they eventually sold to Playboy Industries. And so that was a success because we were able to build something that was, you know, from the customer's point of view, was very seamless and felt very new and somewhat disruptive for the industry. I remember talking to some of the guys at Adam and Eve when I was down at an adult convention in LA, and I told them they had been doing it wrong. And they just looked at me like, who are you? But, you know, I mean, it You know,
yeah, heck yeah.
And now even with the pandemic, through the pandemic, that was some, that was a, you know, an area where people were finding a lot of, finding comfort and pleasure. And that also, you know, really seemed to normalize that a lot amongst Gen Z, who were just, you know, felt very lonely during that time and were seeking connection. And so, you know, making that more approachable for them.
It was
a big deal.
Yeah, taking that the taboo out of it and making it just a thing between, you know, those sorts of things you were doing, and I think movies and pop culture was certainly, you know, normalizing it as well. It was just getting more and more like, well, of course I have a vibrator.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and let me just say, because I did work with Jessica at this time, and we did a lot of paid media during that time, whether it was like billboards and all those.
Well, it's very seasonal. If you remember, it was Valentine's Day is like their Super Bowl.
Oh, Lord.
So we had, I had, you know, really started a campaign in October with Halloween, because Halloween had been kind of abandoned as a holiday, but we brought it back. We brought in more accessory options to kind of build the look, and produced a fetish themed Halloween party,
which was so fun.
Just insane. It was just this dark cabaret of just, you know, immersive art and artists and performers, and it all felt very safe. You know, it was I think between 400 and 600 people came out, and people from everywhere. You know, you had so many different people, and they were, and it felt very joyful. It felt very celebratory, and we were able to do a pop-up shop, and we were able to kind of rethink how we approached people's engagement with the products, and not have it be just a kind of a funny thing that you don't bring up. I mean, I know mothers and daughters that talk about their vibrators with each other now. So, you know, it's fun to be a part of that.
Yeah, there was that brand, I think that what kind of the catalyst was that one brand that was, I think, from Germany. And they had kind of nailed the feeling that we were going for as far as like that product and putting that on the billboards. I mean, we couldn't do in the States what they were doing there, right?
Right. And but they were being like tongue in cheek, but also
the look was so cool though that it worked.
Yeah.
It was so modern.
It felt like a new take on it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. There's only so much you could do when you're talking about like the big O. So they use like the rocket ship or something, right? Like you're so yeah, that was fun. That was funny. Especially when you're putting those all over billboards in LA, which we did. That was
yes,
fun.
We did. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, you know, we all experienced a lot during the pandemic. One, you know, after growing 1,000 plant babies, I decided to get my MBA and, you know, really thought about what I could do to work towards supporting arts and culture in the community that was struggling at the time, and ended up at Seattle Rep Theater. And you know, they were really struggling to bring audiences back after the pandemic. They realized they had, you know, audience that was aging and less diverse than, you know, they kind of had a reckoning there where they realized they had a whole population of, you know, they hadn't been invited to the theater. And, you know, they did a pretty big, I was there when they were looking at them, you know, their programming from a new lens of, you know, how do we tell new stories? You know, because nobody wanted to come out to an Ibsen play, you know, when we were in lockdown, you know, it was the most depressing thing ever. So, you know, how do we bring joy back? And at that time, you'll remember that, you know, music, concerts, that's where people wanted to be. They wanted to be like screaming their face off. They didn't want necessarily thought-provoking, you know, literature.
Right. For sure.
And so it took a little while. It took a little while with performing arts because it's scary to go into a, you know, theater with 1,000 people and you are of a certain age. You know, it wasn't something that the 20-year-olds were worried about as much with Gen Z, but you know, it just became a little bit more of a slow to return. But it was also an opportunity where we could look to new media partners, look to podcasts, look to different neighborhoods, build out programs where we open doors for, you know, marginalized communities and, you know, provide sliding scale. And, you know, I think that we had a couple shows that season that were, I think, were really joyful. We had Fanny, I think, that kicked off that season. And that was kind of like a revival musical that felt very on point with where the country was in this kind of racial reckoning. This is about Fannie Lou Hamer, who is an activist. And I think that eventizing those kind of events changed during that time period, because you traditionally had audiences, they knew what they were doing 4 weeks out. They were ready to purchase way farther out. Yep. But with COVID, you didn't know what you were doing tomorrow if you get a call that somebody in your circle has COVID. So then you are waiting till the last minute to buy those tickets. And that was extremely stressful to be in marketing, because you didn't know what the goal should be.
Right.
You didn't know if you were going to make it. You were pouring dollars into it.
Totally. And nothing's happening. And you're, you know, like, oh my God.
One of the things that I thought of was that, you know, we really couldn't at that moment take away from some of the traditional media and put it into digital. We did over time. But I think that it, you know, I remember when we were talking about who our customer was and found out, I think, Lisa, you did some digging into the analytics and you found out that they over-indexed an affinity for the Cats and Wine. And I don't think they'd mind me even saying that, because so am I. But we wanted to make sure that we were preserving that audience segment and engaging with them on our digital platforms, our digital channels with social media, paid digital, programmatic. But we also knew that we needed to look at new audiences, younger audiences, the young professionals moving to our city. And so we experimented with that a little bit. We had to pull back from some of our traditional broadcasts and move it to OTT or at YouTube in a new way, you know, and because people are spending a lot of time at home and a lot of time on TV, especially the streaming platforms.
So, yeah, it really flipped. That's when it really flipped.
Yeah, from there, I ended up with the Seattle Seawolves, which was exciting for me because my father was a professional rugby player. And so that sport always had a near and dear place in my heart. I grew up attending rugby matches and knowing that I always knew that we were building a team. But with the evolution of Memorial Stadium and the redevelopment there, they have some real opportunity to grow their fan base. For now, they're at Starfire Sports Complex, which is a limited seating venue. I think they've reached capacity several times. So I'm hoping that that will give them some opportunity at Seattle Center to bring the sport more centered within the city. You know, there's a lot of appetite for sports and entertainment in this town. And I don't see that slowing down at all. I think there's more room for more sports. I know we're going to be bringing back the NBA, but, you know, it's becoming a little bit of a crowded space.
Jessica, how would you describe the difference between working on the Seawolves versus when you were working with the Rat City Roller Girls?
Well, I'd say that, you know, the front office at the Seawolves was just really small. It was a really small team. Mm-hmm. And they talked a lot about everyone being a Swiss Army knife. And in marketing, there wasn't a lot of support. So you were doing everything from designing merch to social media to editing photos to writing press releases and, you know, coordinating with press interviews. So it was actually kind of a coming full circle from my Rat City days of where it was all hands on deck. But the difference I'd say is that in women's sports, women tend to be a little bit more collaborative, and we had a model where each skater had to volunteer a certain number of hours. And so, you know, whatever people had strengths in, they would design a job for themselves. So we had the support of a graphic designer and, you know, somebody to go pick up the posters and distribute the posters. And so we had a lot more volunteer help. And it just seemed like the whole vibe of the organization was definitely more collaborative. Yeah. And there was a lot of ownership in that too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah. somebody, you know, I could always put a call out for, hey, we're going to be doing the Special Olympics Polar Plunge. She wants to go, you know, and they'd show up. And so we'd have a lot of, you know, opportunities like that for people to give where they could. And, you know, if you're a web developer working on our website, you know, mm-hmm. and it was a totally different model.
Yeah.
But
it sounds like they didn't have a separation between the administration and the talent, so to speak.
Yeah, it was, you know, like I mentioned, for the skater, by the skater.
Yeah.
We took that very seriously. And there was a lot of pride in building what we could and, you know, stretching beyond what we thought we could achieve. And that was true on the track and off the track.
The energy and momentum that came from that time, it's pretty
Yeah.
I wasn't skating, but I was spending time with you. But I just felt so much of that energy, no matter what we were doing. It was just like, you guys were everywhere.
I think it just reminded me of a campaign where I was actually skating in a bout, but I was also working with this producer who was creating a commercial for Bing. So I was acting, coordinating, facilitating, art directing, playing a match. You can get a lot done when you're on skates. You know, you roll a lot faster, so you can do it all. But yeah, it's still a Bing commercial that's out there that they produce during a match.
Well, you had also secured, I remember all those sponsorships we had. That one I can't remember we had worked on, but there was also Manic Panic. You were doing all kinds of stuff with them, and that was really fun, like really on brand fun stuff.
Yeah, PBR.
PBR.
Natural brand alignment. I had Scion as a sponsor.
Yeah.
We would roll the car in into the arena, and the arena didn't like for us to do that because it's just a fire hazard. So we had to like disconnect the battery and, you know, we put it right in front of the season ticket holders. They take photos with it. And then we got to use it as a moving billboard during the week.
Fun. This is what, like, your career so like accomplished and diverse and the stories, all the stories. Like one time you called me and you're like, oh yeah, I was just hanging out with Ron Jeremy. And I'm like she couldn't believe it herself when she called me. Right.
That's right.
This is my job, just so you know, what the hell.
That was when he had a rum brand.
Right.
Rum brand, and he was doing an appearance at a liquor store. Yeah.
It's just like, just a comment. You were just kind of commenting on your life at the moment. And you're like, yeah, I mean, Ron Jeremy, you know, just, you know, good stuff. Well, I think that is all the time we have. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on. You are definitely someone we need to have back because we haven't even scratched the surface on the fun stuff in your career. So, and I can't wait to see where you go next. So super excited.
Thank you for having me. This has been really fun, just kind of taking a trip down memory lane.
Thanks for listening to the Paid Media Playbook. Want more content like this? Follow our agency, Double Z Media, on LinkedIn. You can find the link in the episode description.